Well, today we're going to be talking about chapters 3 and 4. And I will, if you were dying to talk about Solomon's officials, you know, in chapter 4, and, you know, kind of like the Solomon cabinet and administration, I think you're going to be a little disappointed today. But there is so much going on in 3 that will occupy us. Let's start with just some reminders of, if you like, the legacy of Solomon. When you put the name Solomon into a search window in the New Testament, of course you get the hits of where he occurs in genealogies. But basically there are two things that come up. First, the glory of his kingdom. So remember our Lord in the Sermon on the Mount, consider the lily of the fields. They neither toil nor they spin, but I assure you, not even Solomon in all of his glory was arrayed as one of these. So the glory of the kingdom is something that becomes proverbial, right, for ages afterward. Remember, this kingdom is happening, the reign of Solomon is happening around 900 B.C., so when our Lord is speaking about this, this is almost 1,000 years later. Okay. And then the wisdom of Solomon. So remember that our Lord, at one point where he's engaging the Pharisees, that you know, the Queen of Sheba came from afar to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and you have a greater than Solomon here, and yet you will not hear him. Okay. So again, the wisdom of Solomon, again, becomes proverbial in ages afterwards. Okay. So even though this is a story that's not going to end well, we still want to bear in mind that the reign of Solomon in some ways becomes typological for our Lord. It becomes typological for the reign of Jesus. It becomes a kind of type of way of understanding the way in which Jesus exercises his kingship. There are things, there are the human elements in this narrative that we have to, as it were, factor out. The image that's left is a king that is, in a way, complete in wisdom and rules with glory. Those are the things that we have to hold on to when we're thinking about what this tells us about the reign of Jesus. Okay. So the opening of 3, the beginning of the kingdom. Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter, brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Okay, that's our opening line. Now, commentators, both Rawlinson and I believe here also in this edition, are quick to point out that the marriage of Solomon to Pharaoh's daughter is not necessarily something bad. Remember that in the Old Testament, what's forbidden is that you marry the tribes within the Promised Land, Moabites and Ammonites and so on, Canaanites. That's what's expressly forbidden, because they are going to lead you astray. They are going to lead you into the worship of their gods. The exceptions are that the bride abjures, that it gives up her religion. There's this ritual for giving it up, paring the nails, the cutting of the hair. There's this ritual for abandoning idols. And so when you read the commentators talk about this, well, isn't necessarily doing something bad if the understanding is that the daughter of Pharaoh is not bringing Egyptian gods, you know, into the kingdom, or the worship of false gods. Nonetheless, if I may use an image that's from later in Kings, you are seeing, as it were, a cloud the size of a man's hand on the horizon, which will grow later on into a storm. And what allows me to say that? If you look at chapter 11, the first line of chapter 11, Now King Solomon loved many foreign women. The daughter of Pharaoh, comma, and Moabite, Ammonite, Edenite, Sidonian, Hittite women. Okay, so this is the beginning of something bad. Even if at this particular stage it's not bad, it is the beginning of something bad. The next time that we hear about Pharaoh's daughter, she is first in the line of these strange foreign women who are leading him astray. Now, it could be that in this marriage, it's not that like Egyptian girls are prettier. You know, I mean, the local girls are okay, but you got an Egyptian girl, that's where it's at. This is a political marriage. This is a kingdom that, remember, David was not allowed to build the temple, we're told in Chronicles, because he was a man of blood. That is, his career as a king always involved warfare. It involved warfare with non-Hebrew tribes, but it also involved civil war, sadly, with his own son Absalom. And it's once that civil discord is healed and once they're kind of secure within their borders that he can give to his son a kingdom that's stable. And Solomon really can be a man of peace. Once you've got a stable kingdom, you can start making alliances with the powerful people around you. So the marriage to Pharaoh's daughter is a sign of his strength. It's a sign of his of Israel moving up in the world as a significant power. Okay, but again, nonetheless, even though there isn't evidence that somehow she's bringing false worship, the fact that later on she is in the same sentence with all these other women who are now pulling Israel away from the right path, that shows you it's the beginning of something bad. Verse 2, the people were sacrificing at the high places, however, because no house had been built yet for the name of the Lord. This is connected with the previous verse where it's been talking about not only has there not a palace that's been built, you know, so it almost picture like, you know, Washington, D.C., right before the Civil War, whereas Lincoln is reigning, you're seeing the Capitol building being built. Right? Remember, at the beginning of the Civil War, there's no Capitol building. They are working on that. You can see, we have photographs of it because we had the camera then. You can see them, you know, building the dome. So this is kind of like the kingdom being constructed. We don't have a palace yet, and more significantly, we don't have a temple. Okay, and so people are worshiping, we're told, on the high places. Now, when you look at Deuteronomy chapter 12, this is where it gives instructions about worship. And when it talks about high places, that tends to imply that you're talking about a site of pagan worship. Okay, as the book continues, not Deuteronomy, but I mean the Joshua, Judges, you know, before the building of the temple, the Hebrew people are worshiping in high places. We aren't necessarily doing something idolatrous. Well, let's hear what it says in Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy verse 1 and 2, these are the statutes and ordinances which you shall be careful to do in the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess all the days of your life. You shall surely destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, upon the high mountains, on the hills, under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, burn their asherim with fire. Okay? So in other words, coming into the Holy Land, a high place is a place of pagan worship. No ifs, ands, or buts. Okay. Then, as it continues, verse 10, but when you go over the Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God gives you to inherit, and when he gives you to rest from all your enemies about, so so that you live in safety. Then to the place which the Lord your God shall choose to make his name dwell there, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifice, your tithes, your offerings that you present, all your votive offerings that you vow to the Lord. You shall rejoice before the Lord your God, your sons, your daughters, manservants, maidservants. Take heed, here's the key line, verse 13. Take heed that you do not offer your burnt offerings at every place that you see, but at the place which the Lord will choose in one of the tribes. There you shall offer burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I am commanding you. Okay? So, once you're in the land and you're resting from your enemies, there's a place that will be chosen. Okay? But of course, the problem is up to that point, well, what are we doing up till then? And, you know, there's the tent, you know, there's the tabernacle, right? That's moving around. But also there simply end up being other places where people worship God. So for a while there's a kind of, if you like, kind of ambiguity of what exactly are we supposed to do before there's a proper place of worship that's built. The temple solves that problem. But as you'll notice in going back to Kings, it mentions when Solomon is praying. Hold on a second, I lost my place. Verse 3, Solomon loved the Lord, walking the statutes of David and father, his father. Only he sacrificed and burnt incense at the high places. So he's not doing that at some kind of pagan altar. What he's doing is the high places that the Hebrews are using until there's a clearly designated temple. Okay. Now, as you move further in the book, once you get past the building of the temple, once you start hearing about high places, now this is rebellious. In other words, now we are either doing something which is pagan, which we're going back to Moloch or Ashtoreth, or we're going back to these pagan gods, or we're now in competition with the Temple of Jerusalem. So in other words, once the 10 tribes of Israel break away from the kingdom, right, under Jeroboam, and they set up their own place to worship so that you won't have to go to the temple. Okay? That kind of rebellious worship, that's going to happen at high places, and that's no good. So it's like the difference between people who are pagan and now people who are, to use the Christian term, schismatic. You know, your northern tribes are, you know, in our kind of modern Christian language, are schismatic. They aren't worshiping a different God, but they're worshiping outside the legal structure, or setting up almost a parallel legal structure. Okay, so maybe that's another way to think of, in the time of Jesus, remember the Samaritans. The thing, there's so many things that irritate the Jews about the Samaritans. They're not pure Hebrew. Remember, they're transplanted Assyrians that have kind of intermarried with Jews, so that's irritating. Probably their language and their accent is irritating. But the really irritating thing is that they have this place at Jacob's Well where they understand it's the place of sacrifice. So if you remember in the book of in the Gospel of John, the woman at the well tells Jesus, well, you know, we worship here, and you say that we have to worship in Jerusalem. And that's the beginning and the end of that, because Jesus tells her, the hour is coming now, and now is, when neither here nor in Jerusalem will there be sacrifice offered. Go ahead.
In Judaism today, you'll have people will say, oh, I go to Temple of Aaron or Temple of whatever. And then those are the liberal Jews, because they go, well, we don't need the temple anymore, so they've dismissed the temple.
Yep.
But I went to a synagogue, and we would never call ourselves, because it was conservative.
Yep.
And we would never call ourselves a temple, because a temple is still
is the temple.
Yeah.
There's always one temple. So remember when Daniel, last year when we read the book of Daniel, when Daniel is praying as a captive in Babylon, he is facing toward the temple, or where the temple was. You know, there's this one spot where it's where it's supposed to be. Okay, now that's kind of the, you know, that's kind of the, if you like, the textual or historical element. The, you know, the theological thing that I think is important. I mean, you could read this and see this as history and kind of interesting history, but kind of what then is the spiritual significance? One of the things that when I would be teaching juniors about the sacraments, that they would always struggle with at the kind of the beginning of the unit, even though they've got their catechism, you know, and they can tell me a sacrament is, you know, an outward sign of inward grace and so on. You'd always have some number of kids who would do this. Well, but why do we have to? Why does it have to be sacramental? Why does God have to work that way? Why can't it just be like, you know, oxygen in the air or electricity in the, you know, in the atmosphere? Why does there have to be some determinate system? And sometimes, you know, the more intelligent or skeptical child will say, well, isn't God everywhere? So why do you need some kind of sacramental system or some special building or some special place? Why does it have to be like that? Why can't God just, he's already in you somehow, so why can't he just be sort of like on tap? And one of the things that I realized the more, you know, the more I taught, the more I encountered that, I would have to go back really to things in the Old Testament. For example, when the chosen people come to Mount Sinai, and if you remember, they get all these instructions. You are going to come up to the mountain. You're not going to go on the mountain. There's going to be a trumpet blast. Okay, then you'll be allowed to come a little further. But you're going to hear thunder. You're going to hear lightning. And then Aaron and Moses, they're going to be allowed to go up. God will talk to them. You're going to stay down there. And he'll come back. There are these. You're going to prepare yourself. You're going to purify yourself. You're going to purify your garments. You're going to abstain from sexual activity for 3 days before this happens. What is all that about? It's one thing to say that God is everywhere. That yes, that's true. He's the creator of the universe. He's in all he creates. There's a way in which he's specially, of course, in us because we're made to his image and likeness. But the thing that overlooks is what allows us to realize that presence. You know, for many people, the moment you just say God is everywhere, effectively God is nowhere, because there's nothing special. There's nothing that stands out. It's just, you know, sort of the amorphous, indistinct presence of everythingness which you're just surrounded by. What is going to allow you to realize, that is, take in for yourself, and as it were, see for yourself, that somehow God is present here in a new and special way, that he isn't just present in caterpillars and oak trees and nebulas? Okay? So when you see those instructions in Exodus, you are going to do this. You are going to do that. You are going to do the next thing. God, in his mercy, is helping people realize his presence. We are creatures who depend on our senses. We depend on what we see and hear and taste and touch. And if you have, you try to attempt a religion which really just sort of de-emphasizes the senses, or, you know, rules them out or discounts them, you really are taking away the things that people need. They're not just like great to have. No, they need to realize God's presence. Okay? So later on, when we look at the description of the temple, that's not just there to like build this big, awesome building. That is there to help people have a sense of the greatness of the being that they're worshiping. My father, who lived in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1950s, he would go to these comedy clubs, and of course, one of the regulars who did stand up was Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce is very edgy as a comedian. He was considered edgy in the 1950s, and he's still kind of edgy if you go back and listen to him. But he would say about the Catholic Church, first, the one thing he said, the Catholic Church is the church. It's the only church that gets referred to by this definite article, the. And the other thing he said, I used to think that there was something wrong with Catholics when they have these, they're all these poor people, but they have these, big churches, and they got gold, and they got all these decoration stuff. But then I realized, why would you worship a great big God in a piddly little church? And there's something sort of cynical about that, but there's also sort of something sort of insightful about that. That you make a church reflect the greatness of the being because you're trying to help people visually understand the awesomeness and the beauty of the being that you're drawing them into. Of course, you can actually worship a great God in a piddly little church, but for human beings, that if we could make something bigger and grander and more beautiful, we try to, okay? Or at least that's what we did traditionally. Not speaking for the present age. Archbishop Weakland, who you'll remember is the longtime Archbishop of Milwaukee, he was very much of a kind of a social justice activist bishop, but he did have moments of honesty and reflection like the one I'm about to share. And he said this. This wasn't like in the rumor mill. This was in a Catholic publication. He was in Greece. And he was talking about, I guess he had just come from a service at one of these Greek Orthodox churches. Very lovely, very big. And he's in a cab. And he's complaining to the cab driver about, there are a lot of poor people in Greece. And here, here's this, the church with all this decoration and all this money and so on. I mean, isn't this kind of a scandal? This cab driver just lit into him. That church isn't like just a Greek Orthodox. That belongs to us. That belongs to all of us. It belongs to the people of Greece. Every poor person can walk in that church and be elevated by the beauty that is in that church. That church belongs to the poor as much as it belongs to anybody. Okay? And God bless Rembert Weakland that he actually had the humility to say, I said that, and that cab driver just took me out. Okay? So that's a thing that you have to understand about places of worship. It's not just whatever religious institution it is indulging itself. That really is meant to be an aid to the believer. Let's talk for a moment about these high places. When the pagans are worshiping on hills or mountains, it's precisely because they're tapping into that sense of awe. If you're in a valley or you're in a cave, I don't know that you really have a sense of awe. There's a wonderful moment, I use this with juniors, when I'm talking about kind of realizing God's presence and so on. There's a movie called Touching the Void. It was on Netflix for a long time. And it's about these two mountain climbers who climbed a mountain in Peru, Silla Grande, that no one else had climbed. They were the first climbers to successfully get up this thing. And it's a two-hour movie. The first 20 minutes is getting to the top. The whole rest of the movie is getting down. Because one of the climbers on his way down has a compound fracture on his leg. He breaks his leg. He's the pick that he's trying to hold into the ice, it doesn't hold and he slides, and the lower part of his leg slams into the upper part and splits actually his femur. And and it gets worse after that. But the movie is about basically at one point His colleague is lowering him down by a rope, kind of air 50 feet at a time to try to get him off this mountain. Well, then, of course, a snowstorm comes in, and as he's trying to lower him, he can't see him. And so he lowers him over a crevice. And he can't, he can't see. They can't see each other. They can't hear each other. And the poor guy is up there at the top, not realizing his friend is dangling. And he's not moving, he doesn't know why. He has to cut the rope. And the guy falls 50 feet into this crevice and lives. And so that first guy, he just comes down the mountain, and he's just a wreck. And he assumes his friend is dead. That other guy kind of like gets some of his equipment together and kind of, you know, puts a brace on his leg. And the whole rest of the movie is how he gets down off of that mountain and survives. So it's a true story. It's, you watch it and you just think it's unbelievable. But the first part of that movie is they're going up that mountain and they get to the top of the mountain. And they have these, they play Spem and Allium as they're looking around. Now, if you're not familiar with Spem and Allium, Spem and Allium is a polyphonic Renaissance choral piece by Thomas Tallis. It has 40 parts. In other words, it is 8 five-voice choirs that are all singing these interweaving lines. And so in the movie, you're seeing all these shots of these Andean mountains, you know, glacial, and you're hearing this, overpoweringly beautiful choir singing in Latin. Now it's interesting because these two mountain climbers, particularly the one who falls in the crevice, he's a fallen away Catholic, and he comes off that mountain as a fallen away Catholic. And in fact, that's part of the title. That's part of the reason for the title, Touching the Void, that even if I'm facing, you know, a kind of a hopeless death, would I sort of reach out in prayer to God? And he ends up not doing it. Yeah. So even in that moment, it just never occurred to me that would be something to do. But the interesting thing is the fact that whoever put this film together, when he has these two guys up on top of this mountain, what is he playing? Traditional Catholic polyphony. So in other words, these guys are getting to the top of this mountain, and they're almost having, what else could you describe it, as a spiritual experience. So the reason I have this, I have a little reminder to myself in these high places. Oh, and I even erased my reminder. I put SNR for myself. Spiritual, not religious. Spiritual, not religious. The real objection to having an established place to pray is this movement of kind of spiritual, not religious. Why do I have to go to a building? Why do I have to read a definite book? Why do I have to have a script of prayers? Why do I have to do that stuff? And sometimes what you'll see in some folks in the spiritual, not religious camp is they really pursue nature as a kind of religious experience. So these two guys who are on the top of Suya Grande, and just sort of awed by everything around them. You know, when I was a boy, I went mountain climbing in Alaska. And you get on top of a mountain, it really is an experience that fills you with awe. It makes you feel small. And there's just this beauty around you that can be really intense and overwhelming. Okay? And so people then will substitute that. They're really substituting something emotional for something spiritual, right? There is this awe that you have up there, but as C.S. Lewis describes it very well in Mere Christianity, the problem is you have this feeling of awe, but it goes nowhere. You don't do something with it. You know, the attraction of that kind of spiritual, not religious, is there isn't some kind of definite duty or steps that you're supposed to take. You get up, you feel awe, you go back down, and you kind of go on with your life. Okay, the thing precisely that's unattractive, you know, about traditional worship, but also a sign that this is kind of what you need, is you're told to do things. There are steps. There are ways of taking whatever awesome experiences you had and now seeing that in light of other people's experience. Even other people's religious experience, especially other people's religious experience. So the way that he puts it, the way that Lewis puts it, theology you may think of as boring. You like this kind of intense experience that you're having. But look, if you're on the shore of the Atlantic Ocean and you've got a map, looking out at the ocean is more exciting than looking at the map. But if you want to get to the other side of the ocean, you need the map, or whoever's taking you needs the map. Because however unexciting the map may be, it is the collection and synthesis of other people's experiences. Okay? So when the pagans are doing things like worshiping in the high places, all these kind of various religious, if you like, alternatives, they're doing things that may be in a way reaching out for the divine or groping for the divine, but unless God somehow reaches back, unless somehow God is trying to talk to you as well, you in some way are just kind of making up your own script, and it can merely be shaped by what it is that you kind of like and what it is you're kind of into. Okay. The thing about traditional worship is it's a check kind of on your own desires and your own inclinations. There are all sorts of things in traditional prayer or traditional worship that I might not be all that crazy about, but I trust in it because this is somehow really going to give me a greater sense in the long run of the divine than what I would do on my own. Kneeling is uncomfortable. There's no two ways about it. Kneeling is uncomfortable, but it's a little hard to convey that you are lowering yourself in the presence of some kind of higher and greater being if you simply never kneel. That doesn't mean that all prayer needs to be done on your knees, but it does mean that there has to be times when, in fact, that's exactly what you do. Okay? If there isn't some kind of sense of your prostrating yourself, of lowering yourself. Okay? So one way to look at these high places is, you know, think about the trend or the tendency to just kind of want to do religion on your own terms. You know, DIY religion, DIY spirituality. You create it in a way that fits the best with you. If you are really getting something authentically from God, it's not going to fit you perfectly. It's certainly not going to fit you well right away. You've got to adapt to it. You've got to adapt to the worship, the ritual, what God is giving you. It is not something that's just going to fit like a glove. It is something that demands some kind of change on your part. Okay? So to take down the high places is a way to take down the do-it-yourself religion, to take down just fashioning according to your own likes, your own images. You know, we're not going to be like Canaanites and put out a calf. But that's because we're not thinking about fertility. We're not worried about fertility. There's a store out there. It's full of food. Just go shopping. Use your ATM. You're good. Okay? But obviously there would be other things that we would worship, that we would magnify instead. Well, talking about chapter 3 wouldn't be complete unless we didn't talk about the judgment of Solomon. Remember that Solomon prays for wisdom. And we talked about this a little bit. I had described Bathsheba as possibly being devious. And for one of you pointed out, I think it was you, not devious, maybe shrewd. Maybe someone she has good judgment. And when you look at the term wisdom in this chapter, when Solomon prays for wisdom, remember it's a certain kind of wisdom. It's not wisdom, understanding, cosmic causes, understanding the unfolding of the universe, natural virtues. It isn't like that. Give me the wisdom to judge this people. Okay? When we think of a ruler, especially when we think of a king, we are really shaped by, I think, almost the mythology that we have of medieval kings, where we think of them basically just getting whatever they want or commanding whatever they want. And that just does not describe kingship. Kingship is you are under all sorts of traditions, customs, limitations. You know, to use something that's kind of closer to the modern world, the Queen of France, do you realize that when the Queen of France gave birth, she delivered a baby in a room full of people? There were 40 to 50 people in that room because there had to be witnesses that baby came from the queen and is the dauphin, is the prince. You know, if those were the terms, I don't know that a lot of you ladies would really want to be queen. Okay? I mean, what?
The consummation also?
I don't remember that, but if that's true, just as disturbing. I think that's, yeah, and I think that's probably true. But by the way, that I can think of cultures where consummation was something that even like commoners in some ways made public. You remember in Greece, in rural Greece, after the wedding night, you would hang out the bed sheets over the balcony to demonstrate that your wife had not been experienced. You were proclaiming that. Now, there are things about traditional societies in general that to us are, you know, but of course, people in that era would be just as baffled by the fact that I suppose they would say, yeah, maybe hanging the bed sheets over the balconies over the top, but you guys don't seem to care at all. You guys just seem to marry after some kind of indiscriminate sexual history. You've been living together for 3 years, and maybe you marry and maybe you don't. And you know, from their point of view, ours would be just as baffling. Our customs would be just as bizarre, even more bizarre. So let's talk about the judgment of Solomon. He has two women, two ladies of the evening, and the dispute is over their baby. Who does it belong to? Because one of these women, apparently during the night, rolled over on her own child and suffocated it. And once she found it dead, she took the other woman's baby and said it was hers. Now, when we think of the king, the first and most important job of the king is judgment. So when we think of our executive, right, the presidency does not involve judgment, right? That's a court system. That's a judicial system. We have an executive branch that's kind of like a monarch, and then we have a judicial branch. In most traditional societies, that is one person, or that is the same group of people. To be a ruler involves judgment. Be like in England, where you had the big house guy, the guy who had the big manor house. Very often, he was also the magistrate. He was going to be the local person who heard cases. So that's Solomon's job. So what he thinks of first in terms of ruling is, give me the ability to judge this people, not just sort of lead this people, but do the responsibility that's essential to being a king. So when these ladies are brought before him, how are you going to determine whose baby this is? DNA testing. No, he doesn't have any technology. Somehow, the idea of wisdom is that, in this case, is that somehow what's on the inside would be obvious to you. Somehow what's to be a judge, this sounds over the top again, but to be able to read hearts, that you would be able to look into these people somehow and know what the real facts of the matter was. So that when he says, get a sword, divide the child, they can split it. The mother, who's the true mother, of course, she's sick within herself. And the mother who's lost her child, who's probably still angry and resentful about it, fine, cut him in half. Right? Nope. The mother that has said, let the other have it, that's the true mother. And everybody, right? Awesome. Right? How did he do that? Okay? Because he knew what to say that would bring out what was in their hearts. He knew what to say which would expose what was really going on the inside. See, that's judgment. That in this case, that what's just inward or hidden becomes outward and public. In the one of the commentaries I was looking at, I think it's, it was Cornelius Elapide. He was talking about there was in ancient Rome, there was a mother who wouldn't admit that this young man was her son. And so I think it was the emperor said, okay, if he's not your son, I'm going to arrange for you two to be married. And that did it. she admitted the boy was hers. That's a similar kind of thing. Again, very edgy, but it But it did the job. It exposed what was happening on the inside of those people. So again, you have to connect. When I know when I first read Kings and I saw that passage about the wisdom, again, I thought of wisdom almost like a gift of the Holy Spirit kind of wisdom, you know, where you have the, almost like a kind of a vision of God and understanding. This is a very practical wisdom. You know, Solomon sees that he's young, and he sees that he needs help in order to rule. And the thing that you need to rule is to be able to see inside people. And of course, that's what makes his fall later on so sad. That he's able to see inside these women, but as he grows older, he's not able to see inside himself. That he is not able to see what is happening to his own heart. That he's not able to see the influence that these strange women that he's marrying is having on him. So much easier to judge others than judge yourself, is it not? Very good. So we're out of time. Again, if people want to retire out to the atrium and ask some more. By the way, let me say before, I was meant to say this at the beginning. If there are things that I don't touch on or don't get to, that are interesting to you or you want to ask about, please feel free to email me, you know, Arthur Hippler at, I guess, providenceacademy.org or prov.academy, whatever, either one would work. Anyway, just, it's in the directory. Just email me, because it could be that you're, you know, asking about something that's very important that I should talk about. So if I don't touch on something or something's interesting, please email me, let me know. Very good, thank you. Oh.